Hi, everybody. Welcome to the fourth edition of the Diplomats U.S. Teams podcast on geopolitics. I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
And I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And today we actually have a special guest with us. Shannon, if you want to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Shannon Tiezzi, also based in Washington, and I am the China Power blogger for The Diplomat.
Thank you, Shannon. Thanks, Shannon, for being here. Today we're actually going to talk about the MH370 missing plane, which we talked about last week. We're also going to talk about Taiwan protesters occupying the legislature, and then we're probably going to wrap up with the talk about U.S.-Filipino relations in the context of the New Deal over military access. So, Ankit, can you start us off maybe talking about the MH370 plane?
Absolutely. So since last week's podcast when we talked about MH370, there have been a lot of updates. Most recently, Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott said that Australian maritime surveillance had turned up credible debris in the Indian Ocean. And I believe that they're checking it out at this point, but nothing's been confirmed yet. But the evidence is consistent with the last satellite ping trajectory of the flight, possibly. If readers recall, there were two possible paths the plane could have taken once it left the South China Sea and flew over Malaysia. One of those was an air corridor leading up over Myanmar, over China, ending up in Central Asia near Kazakhstan, and the other one was going south into the Indian Ocean. So if this evidence turns up anything, then it's consistent with that second trajectory. That also comes after reports from the Maldives, where residents actually reported seeing a jumbo jet flying super low, and I believe people attempted to follow up on that, but we're unclear about where that is right now. But since we have Shannon on today, we thought we'd talk a bit about any lasting effects that this MH370 saga might have on bilateral relations between China and Malaysia. So Shannon, what are your thoughts on where this incident might take relations between those two countries?
It definitely has the potential to throw a wrench into China-Malaysia relations. Those two countries have had a very special relationship since the 1970s, when Malaysia actually became the first of the ASEAN nations to diplomatically recognize China. And since then, they've enjoyed very friendly ties. Outside of Japan and Korea, Malaysia is actually China's largest trading partner in Asia. And China is, of course, Malaysia's single largest trading partner. So economically, there's a lot going on there. And that's actually could be threatened by what we're seeing with MH Flight 370. Definitely Chinese tourism to Malaysia, which has been a pretty important part of that economic relationship, is going to take a hit from this. You can almost guarantee that you're going to see less Chinese tourists willing to go there. Politically, though, as well, the Chinese government has been increasingly willing to publicly scold the Malaysian authorities and also allowed some state media outlets to become even more nasty in terms of saying that they're incompetent, they're contradicting themselves, they're not doing enough. So it would be interesting to see if this kind of becomes a source of lingering resentment between the two countries, even after this crisis is eventually resolved.
Absolutely. I think it's exposed some shortcomings in the Malaysian government that I think even its neighbors in ASEAN are taking note of. I mean, just one thing I'd add, actually, is that Malaysia is a multi-ethnic country. They have a 40%, I believe, Chinese minority, which has a pretty significant voice in the country's politics, although not part of the main ruling coalition. And traditionally, Chinese families in Malaysia have been kind of commercially very powerful. And I've been reading some commentary coming out of Malaysia that the Barisan National Coalition government that's been in power for the past 40 to 50 years is going to have some trouble with their Chinese electoral base over this MH370 event. It remains to be seen, you know, how quickly this might be forgotten if the debris is found and, you know, the two countries do decide to move on, but it could become a sticking point in Malaysian domestic politics as well.
I think just to try to put a defense aspect to the whole crisis is that actually I think it was Trevor Moss who writes for us, who used to write for us sometimes, he is now with the Wall Street Journal. He brought up the point that it's showing the weaknesses in the air defense systems in the region, all the way through to India and Pakistan, but also Malaysia, of course, and also the lack of cooperation, which Carl Thayer pointed out on the Flashpoints earlier this week. So I think that's an interesting aspect too. But I agree that I think China might. It seems like to get at for the domestic political reasons might hurt its relationship with Malaysia by trying to blame Malaysia for all the failings and everything.
Absolutely. So let's move on and talk a bit about the events going on in Taiwan right now. So Shannon, do you want to maybe tell us a bit about the protests going on in Taipei?
Sure. So just a little bit of background. Back in 2008, when current Taiwanese President Ma Ying-jeou was first elected, he made a promise that he was going to really improve cross-strait relations between Taiwan and mainland China. And he's acted on that, especially in the economic sphere. In 2010, Taiwan and China signed a major economic agreement, the Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement, that brought down a lot of trade barriers between the two. In the summer of 2013, Taiwan and China negotiated and agreed upon an update to the ECFA, which is the Cross-Strait Services Trade Agreement. But that's causing Ma Ying-jeou's government a lot of trouble in terms of actually getting this ratified. In addition to the vested interest groups that are always at risk when you're talking about removing protective trade barriers and are worried about losing jobs and losing money, there's also, of course, the extra element of people who believe that engaging with China economically is just in general a bad idea for Taiwan, because it could chip away at Taiwanese sovereignty, to make Taiwan dependent on Beijing. So because of these various concerns, there's been a lot of domestic opposition to actually ratifying in the legislature this trade services agreement. And that really culminated this past week when the KMT, it seems like, finally got fed up with the opposition and decided that they were just going to try to push this bill through after not really honoring their previous promise that each separate clause would be reviewed one by one. When this news came out, a group of protesters actually stormed the legislature. So they're now occupying Taiwan's legislative yuan. According to Taiwan's reports, they're mostly students, but there are just some kind of NGO activists mixed in there. And outside of the yuan, there are thousands, ranging from between 2,000 to 10,000, depending on the time of day, of protesters outside lending their support to these students and activists who've occupied legislative yuan. And they are insisting that the government, the ruling KMT party, drop its plan to bring the bill to a vote on Friday, which the KMT has enough seats to just pass this bill in a straight up or down vote. And they're insisting that it be brought back for a clause by clause review. And the latest news, they've basically given Ma Ying-jeou's government an ultimatum. They said if by noon on Friday, which would be close to midnight Eastern Standard Time on Thursday, if they haven't received any positive response to their demands, they're going to take further action. And it's unclear exactly what that means. This could easily get worse before it gets better.
Absolutely. This seems like a watershed event in Taiwanese politics in recent memory. What do you think the long-term influence will be for Taiwanese politics in terms of the KMT and the DPP and their sort of political future in the country?
I would say what's really interesting about this protest is that they've really avoided identifying themselves with the DPP. Obviously, the DPP, as the opposition party who has been against the service agreement, is kind of claiming this as a victory. But the protesters themselves, when they issued their statement, said that this is not about blue versus green, which is the code name for the two parties. It's not about China versus Taiwan. This is about elite corporate interests kind of usurping the democratic process and trying to ram things through that might not be good for the average Taiwanese. So in that sense, it will be very interesting to see if this ends up benefiting either party. It's easy to assume that, oh, this is a victory for the DPP, but it doesn't sound like the protesters are very pleased with them either.
But do you think it reveals somewhat of a generational shift in Taiwanese politics? I mean, a lot of younger Taiwanese are generally not very interested in the KMT's pursuits with China.
Yeah, it's definitely, as you said, this is something we've never seen before. It's fairly unprecedented for this amount of protests to come through. And I think it really is a conglomeration of a bunch of different strands that are very hot button issues. You have Taiwan's relationship with China, which people are very sensitive about. You have economic interests where people are standing to lose a lot of money, and a lot of students, which they make up the bulk of the protests, are already concerned about unemployment, not being able to find a job. So they're really upset about the possibility that Taiwan could have even more unemployment. And then you also have the perception among these activists that basically the KMT is trying to pull a fast one on them, is trying to bypass normal democratic procedures in order to get this bill through.
Mm-hmm. One thing I just want to bring up is, I mean, Shan, what do you think this will have in terms of Taiwan's negotiations for the TPP and the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership? Go on.
Yeah, it definitely called into question Ma Ying-jeou's ability to actually deliver on negotiations that have been concluded. And that could have ramifications for joining the TPP and other regional bilateral trade agreements or multilateral trade agreements. And it could also be very damaging for relations between the PRC and Taiwan. If people who are negotiating with Ma Ying-jeou, with his government representatives, think, well, maybe I'm negotiating and then we won't be able to get this bill through the legislature, it really kind of makes you not as keen to talk to them and spend all the time hammering out an agreement when it might not go anywhere.
Yeah, I was actually talking with some of Taiwan's sort of diplomats a few weeks ago before these protests started, and I asked them about this because I heard some rumblings about or not really believing President Mao could get these bills through, the China trade bills through, and they dismissed all like considerations that like this might that Mao wouldn't be able to get trade deals through. And I think that, you know, this kind of puts this whole protest kind of put this whole thing in doubt.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because as big as these protests are, the KMT is still the majority party in Taiwan, so it's tough to say even if they were to hold an election tomorrow, would the majority of people vote against the KMT or would they still stay in power? You know, it's kind of tough to judge if this is damaging enough to really get rid of the ruling coalition that's been built up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see this everywhere, I feel like, these days. We actually had a piece on the editor's blog kind of about this, that, like, you know, from everywhere from Thailand to even Ukraine and stuff, we have these sometimes minorities or just slight majorities causing huge ruckuses, for lack of a better word, and it's subverting pretty much the democratic process, really. I mean, it's basically what's going on. So, I have no idea if this is a majority feeling in Taiwan, but it seems possible to me that it's just some students that, you know.
Yeah, just a curious parallel with other current events is that, you know, not too long ago, we had another country where protesters stormed parliament protesting an economic agreement with a neighboring country that was trying to strong-arm its politics. So we all know how things ended up over there.
Yeah, maybe China will move in to protect.
Yeah, well, let's hope not.
Yeah, well, I would say, obviously, this is kind of an out-there scenario, but it is a risk that if China feels that it's not going to get anywhere negotiating with Taiwan because of Taiwan's domestic politics, it might start to more seriously consider alternative options. Not even necessarily a military invasion. I'd say that's very unlikely, but economic coercion, more political coercion and things like that might start to creep back into the discussion.
Right. I mean, the KMT has at least maintained a sort of political equilibrium that's been acceptable to China. If, you know, China sees these domestic protesters kind of rising up, usurping democratic processes, kind of knocking years of the KMT's understanding of cross-strait relations out of the window, then that's when, you know, they'll start thinking more seriously about other options.
Mm-hmm. I think this also, though, sort of, I mean, if there ever was a period where Taiwan went for the Hong Kong option, as John Mearsheimer calls it, this I think would be exactly China's fears. Is that if Taiwan was part of China and something like this happened, I mean, I think it would have a terrible impact on, or could potentially have a terrible impact on China, the mainland China. So I mean, I think this is a real danger for as far as China's long term goal of getting Taiwan as part of the country is that. You know, they do have a history of democracy, and there could be protests, and those protests could look badly end up badly for China's mainland interests.
Absolutely. So should we move on and talk a bit about the U.S.-Philippines defense agreement that's almost complete and is a major reversal of the Philippines' policy since 1992 of having the United States have no presence there.
Yeah, well, limited presence. I actually wrote a piece about this, so I guess I should probably take it. Basically, on Friday, the Philippines announced that it would basically worked out the major issues with the U.S. as far as getting more, giving the U.S. more access to military access to parts of the Philippines. So we still don't have exactly a ton of details, but it looks like it's going to be the U.S. is going to have military bases in like five different places or six different places in the Philippines, which is kind of in line with the U.S. goal to have a more dispersed presence in the Asia Pacific in general and the South China Sea. So this is obviously very significant in terms of the U.S. Rebounds to Asia, because it'll give it way better access to the South China Sea, basically. And also, it should be signed. I think they're both the two sides are really trying to get all the details hammered out in time for President Obama's trip to the Philippines next month.
Right. Do you think this will placate some critics of the rebalance to Asia, that this is a major deliverable in the sense that the United States is actually getting significant bases around the South China Sea?
Well, I guess it depends on which critics. I think some critics just are, you know, Republicans that want to criticize the president because they're on different political parties. But yeah, I mean, I think it'll definitely be a watershed moment in sort of, just so to speak, in terms of the Asia pivot. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is, you know, one of the major deliverables in what the United States could have done as it's rebalancing to Asia. I think it makes perfect sense for the Philippines as well. I mean, it's a textbook example of, you know, external balancing. The Philippines has obviously seen tensions with China ramp up, and it's not surprising that they turn to an ally and invite them into their within their borders to have a significant military presence. It's really quite textbook, makes good sense for them. And I think it's, you know, China only has itself to blame essentially for provoking the Philippines. If it hadn't done so, then, you know, they might not have to go there.
That's what I said in the report. But Shannon, when we bring up China, can you? What do you think China's reaction is going to be? I mean,
I think you're going to see a very similar reaction, possibly stronger, to what China had when Obama announced in 2011 that the U.S. is going to be stationing Marines in Darwin, Australia, which is basically they accused the U.S. of having a plot to contain China. They accused the U.S. of actually destabilizing this security situation by bringing additional troops and military forces into that, and they'll use that to question U.S. intentions for the region. China really sees itself, or at least officially portrays itself, as the victim in these territorial disputes. According to the China narrative, U.S. allies such as Japan and the Philippines are the ones provoking China. And they're provoking China because they've been emboldened by promises of protection from the U.S. So I don't actually think this is going to change the way China engages with the Philippines over these territorial disputes. If anything, it will give China more leeway, at least domestically, to blame the U.S. For indirectly causing Philippine aggression, what China would consider to be Philippine aggression.
Yeah. One thing I think when you're looking at the map, as far as the U.S. goes, is that if it gets these bases and then also gets the Vietnam, return access to the Vietnam base, Cam Ranh, I mean, it really is going to have kind of a circular presence around the South China Sea. And actually, that might set it up to, if it gets Malaysia on board, to sort of have a anti-access area denial strategy towards China, where in the South China Sea, where it can hold at risk China Navy assets and Air Force assets in the South China Sea. So I think it could ultimately be very significant.
Absolutely, and it'll also enable, you know, quick deployment and resupplying in any eventual South China Sea conflict.
Yeah, right. I should mention Subic Bay actually real quick. That it doesn't look like they're getting access to Subic Bay, which is the former military base that served as the head of the headquarters of the 7th Fleet in the Pacific. And at first I thought that was kind of shocking, but Stacey Pettyjohn of RAND Corporation, I was talking with her on Twitter, and she brought up the part that it probably was mostly symbolic for the Philippines' domestic politics. So I think that's it's interesting, but it's not really a big setback for the U.S.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
So I think that about wraps it up this week. Shannon, thanks for joining us. We really appreciated your insight on China and Taiwan affairs.
And, yeah, you're welcome, guys.
And we'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.